Hi, I'm Lorenzo. Actually, I have two presentations. The first one is about this work with, in joint collaboration with Massi Kochbin from UC Santa Barbara and Matt Liefer from Chapman University. You can find more about it at this reference or also in the archive. And it's basically about testing non-classicality in a very simple, realistic experimental scenario that is referred to here as the simplest scenario. Because in the context of preparation contextuality, which is one of the notions of non-classicality that we address here, that's the simplest scenario where you can test it. So what is this scenario about? So it's a scenario where you have just four preparations and two tomographically complete measurements. Here, the assumption of tomographic completeness just means that we uniquely identify these preparations with these two measurements. We cannot have other measurements that would distinguish more. In particular, this ideal scenario, so before we put any noise, is the one where we want to prepare these four preparations in blue here, and we have the two measurements, let's say, with X and Y, because we know that in these situations, this would provide a test of contextuality, actually. If you imagine this to be like a section of the Bloch sphere and you prepare these four pure states, we know that this actually would constitute a maximal violation of non-contextuality inequalities. Moreover, let me say about these preparations here, label them with 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, because these are also usually used in some communication tasks where you want to encode like a 2-bit string that a sender sends to a receiver, like in quantum random access codes or parity Bayes multiplexing, these kind of games. Moreover, let me say that, crucial for defining preparation contextuality or non-contextuality is the notion of operational equivalence. And here, the operational equivalence that we're going to test is the one associated with this red spot that represents a completely mixed state. Because you see that if you take a half mixer of 1, 1, and 0, 0, or a half mixer of 1, 0, and 0, 1, they are operationally equivalent in the completely mixed state. But of course, this is an ideal scenario. In reality, what you have is more something like this, okay, where basically now you no longer can prepare your pure states as before, but you have these mixed ones, and also the operational equivalences shift. Okay, also you see these half points between the two couples preparations are misplaced. And so how do we test preparation contextuality in this scenario? I mean, there is an established method that in this scenario is due to Matt Pusey, where basically you test contextuality for this a posteriori operational equivalence, not with respect to the original one. And so it was able to come up with these non-contextuality inequalities that if you violate, you have a proof of contextuality. But here really comes the motivation for our work, because there are certain scenarios where you don't want to talk about the a posteriori operational equivalence or the a posteriori preparations. You would like to refer back to the ideal ones. Because, I don't know, before I mentioned the parity Bayes multiplexing protocol, in that protocol, the assumption of the parity constraint was encoded in the fact that we had that operational equivalence in the center, okay? So we would like still to refer to that. And so that's why now I come to the slide where I show like a summary of our results. So basically what we do is, in this simplest scenario, we consider several approaches, and I also say in the second column which notion of non-classicality they test, and if they have a reference to the a priori preparations or not. And moreover, we find a noise bound below which these methods still witness a violation of the classicality. And so, for example, for the Pusey's method, we find that if we have low enough noise, 0.006, this is just the distance between the ideal and the noisy preparations, then this is still violated. Then we do that also for another method developed by Iman Marvian, still to test preparation contextuality. And in that sense, we see that this method is more robust, if you want. But the main reason why we consider also this method by Marvian is because it allows us to connect to actually what is the main character of our work, which is that we provide a method to test another notion of non-classicality, which is this violation of a bounded ontological distinctness, or BOD. The idea of bounded ontological distinctness is just to generalize the notion of non-contextuality insofar as you demand that not only operational equivalences are preserved at the ontological level, but also differences, okay? And so what we were able to do is to connect some of these results and also show that as long as you are below this noise threshold, then you have this violation. So if you really want the upshot of all these results is that we ultimately find that As long as you are below, you have low enough noise, then all these methods agree in detecting non-classicality, and an experimenter can choose whatever they want. As an application of our result, we also look at the case of parity oblivious multiplexing in the presence of noise and show that if you perform with a probability of success better than the classical one, where now also some parity is leaked because of the noise, then this involves a violation of bounded ontological distinctness, which is the thing that powers the game. So I know I said many things, but I hope I made you just curious about this work, and if you're interested, just come to me later and ask me any question. With this, I go to the next one. No, it's not me.
Thank you.
Yeah, so my talk, I'm from the University of Colorado in Boulder. My name is Matthew, and my talk is on, is entanglement actually necessary for BPP to not equal BQP? Just a quick poll, show of hands, who thinks the answer is yes? I haven't defined what this means. So a few hands, maybe. Okay, so yeah, what does this mean? Like, if you're doing like MBQC, like probably yes, because you need that entangled resource state. But what about in a different model of computation? It seems to depend on the exact model. For those of you familiar with DQC1, that complexity class, it's sort of the germ of where this idea comes from. So maybe to formalize the question a little bit more, but not totally, does every, say, uniform and polynomial-sized circuit over some gate set that solves some problem that is, say, in BQP but not in BPP necessarily entangle its input? And what that could mean is that you start out with some product state like this for some instance x, and then you feed it into a quantum circuit, and by necessarily entangle its input at some layer, that state has become entangled. The answer to this question is yes, assuming BPP is not equal to BQP, because you could just use a simple tensor network simulation if at every layer it were separable, because then every bipartition is not entangled. So it's efficiently classically simulable. So maybe this is not the right formalization of that question in terms of more complexity theoretic terms. Another way you might ask it is, what if you do some classical pre-processing on this state? So you have some language that we say no is in BQP but not in BPP. That's our assumption. Could you solve L ever like this, where you take your input x, your bit string x, you first feed it into some classical computer, and it gives you some output distribution. With that distribution, you can construct a mixed state. And if we now feed that mixed state into our quantum computer and enforce that with respect to that input state, every layer is separable, could we solve L like that? So that's kind of the question that I'm interested in pursuing. And of course, this is not the exact definition of a non-entangling quantum computer. You could, you know, have measurements in the middle, for example. But all of this and ideas similar to it allow us to define a new complexity class, which we're calling BQP-SEP, where the separable means that you're not exploiting entanglement in any canonical way. And basically, this class is just, L is in this class if it's in BQP and you don't need entanglement to decide it. Where specifying again what you mean by don't need entanglement is a little bit tricky. But the key properties, once you go through the formalization of this, is that this class is intermediate between BPP and BQP. You get that because the initial input state is itself realizable on a BPP machine, so just appending the identity circuit after gives you everything in BPP, basically. If you could show that BPP equals this class, then entanglement is indeed necessary to solve any separating problem. Perhaps it'll be the case, though, that this BQP SEP is just BQP, in which case all that matters in achieving languages in BQP is not quantum correlations, but just correlations. So some complexity questions associated with this class are, one, of course, is BPP equal to it? More reasonable questions that we can get our hands on, if you allow post-selection in this class, does it equal post-BQP, and does the polynomial hierarchy collapse, which would just be evidence for it being hard to simulate classically? Related to that is, how can you talk about deferred measurements in BQP SEP? It's not clear if you want to do some sort of intermediate measurement how you could just relate that to a different BQP SEP circuit, because you can't entangle and defer the measurement until the end. And then, of course, you could get into more complexity theoretic things. Are there relative separations you can show by defining something like a non-entangling oracle and things like this? So this is just the germ of a little research program that is just getting off the ground of where I'm from. So thank you.
Hello, and welcome to my talk on universal algorithm for transforming Hamiltonian eigenvalues. This is joint work with my former research group at the University of Tokyo, Tatsuki Otake, Philip Taranto, and Mio Murao. So in this talk, I'm going to talk about simulating quantum systems. Now, so far, most of the research on simulating quantum systems is related to a Hamiltonian simulation, where there is some Hamiltonian H given to us with a classical description, and then our task is to simulate the dynamics of that Hamiltonian, so some unitary corresponding to e to the minus I ht for a Hamiltonian h. But in many scenarios, we might not actually already have the classical description of the Hamiltonian. So perhaps we're given the Hamiltonian by some untrusted party, or even more fundamentally, maybe we're given the Hamiltonian as a black box coming from nature. So maybe we're doing an experiment and the Hamiltonian just appears in nature and we don't yet know what it is. So what we consider in this work is simulating a kind of a black box of Hamiltonian. So we're given a black box access to some Hamiltonian dynamics, and we want to simulate some functional transformation of this Hamiltonian dynamics. So given e to the minus I ht, we want to get e to the minus I f of ht prime for some new time t prime and some function f of the Hamiltonian h. And in order to achieve functional transformations of black box dynamics, we use the framework of higher order quantum computation. So the framework of higher order quantum computation is a recent paradigm of quantum computation focused on the idea of functional transformations, which can be seen as the analog in quantum computing to functional programming in classical computing. So we all know that classical computing is modular. You know, I can take a function f and take another function g and compose the functions, take the function f of g or g of f. But the usual way that quantum algorithms are designed now is rather that you have some input states and you apply a sequence of unitary gates or quantum channels. So higher order quantum computation aims to really elevate quantum computation to the same regime of functional programming where we can have higher order functions of unitary gates, so transforming unitary gates themselves. In this work, we particularly consider transformations of unitary gates given by Hamiltonian dynamics. So in this work, we showed that we can perform a universal transformation of the eigenvalues of any Hamiltonian by any sufficiently differentiable function f. So if you give me some Hamiltonian h, and you ask for some desired function f that is sufficiently differentiable, I'll give you back the dynamics of the transformed Hamiltonian f of h. Our algorithm is deterministic and approximate with an error epsilon and the time complexity scales polynomially in all of the variables of interest. The way this algorithm works is that we have our system Hamiltonian evolving, e to the minus iht, and we let it evolve in short time bursts, t over n, and we do that n times. And in the middle, between those short time bursts, we will perform some fixed quantum gates on both a system and an auxiliary system. And the overall evolution of those fixed gates and the short time bursts for the Hamiltonian evolution corresponds to the evolution of the transformed Hamiltonian system f of h. So it really, we can simulate this transformed Hamiltonian f of h. Now, this algorithm is constructed in the form of functional programming. So at a low level, as I said, what we're doing is we take the Hamiltonian, let it evolve a short times, and we apply some fixed gates. And those fixed gates correspond to what we would call a kind of higher order transformation, while the short bursts correspond to the unitaries that are being transformed. But at the higher level, we can think of it as being concatenated from many higher order transformations that perform specific functions that lead to our overall function. So first, we simulate a negative time evolution. The way we do this is that we start with a Hamiltonian e to the minus iht, which we are given, and we perform an algorithm that takes any such Hamiltonian as input and outputs the dynamics of the positive time evolution, e to the plus iht prime. And to do this, we just used a previous algorithm found in an earlier work of ours. But in particular, in this paper, we showed a new algorithm for simulating the negative time evolution of any Hamiltonian that can be done without any auxiliary qubits, which means that we can take any Hamiltonian we like, let it evolve as if it had been going back in time to a time before we even started the experiment. Secondly, we take this negative time evolution and as input to another function, higher order function, that simulates the control dynamics. So we can get the controlled version of both the plus positive and negative time dynamics. Finally, so the previous one also came from another previous work, but our new algorithm we now developed is simulating the Fourier series. So we take a Fourier series of this function f, and we simulate that using taking as input the controlled dynamics, finally outputting e to the minus I f of ht, i.e. the transformed Hamiltonian dynamics. The final step in this procedure is the step of constructing the compilation. So what we do is, in each of those three steps, simulating the negative time evolution, simulating the control dynamics, and the Fourier series, we use some randomized algorithms approach. So we would randomly pick some choice of fixed gates according to some probability distribution that depends on the function f. But because we have many sequences of randomness, those choices of randomness are no longer optimal when we compose them all together. So we perform a generalized compilation of the higher order algorithms together, all the three higher order subroutines, globally to improve the time complexity overall in the whole algorithm. So by concatenating multiple higher order subroutines, we're able to build a higher order quantum algorithm that for any Hamiltonian h and any function f, you give me the black box Hamiltonian e to the minus I ht, and I give you the new Hamiltonian e to the minus I f of h t prime. So if you're interested in, like this short introduction, if you're interested in higher order computation, tomorrow there'll be another talk in the context of blind quantum computation and security by Thomas Vinette. So thank you very much for your attention.
Hi everyone, I'm Gabrielle Tourner, I'm a PhD at UBC and I'm working on topological measurement-based quantum computation with Sven Bachmann and Robert Hausendorff. So first I would like to introduce a bit like what measurement-based quantum computation in 3D cluster state is. So 3D cluster state is a lattice made of unit cell like that with qubits on the faces and on the edges. And it's characterized by stabilizers that are x on one qubit and z on the neighboring qubits. And we can have stabilizers on the primal faces like that or on the dual faces like that centered on the black qubits. By measuring qubits in the bulk, we can project a Torii code on the surface of the cluster state. So here, a cluster face will correspond to a Torii code placket, and by measuring in X here, we will enforce the Z stabilizers of the Torii code. By measuring in Z, this qubit here, we won't enforce the stabilizer, and we will create holes in the Torii code. And holes in the Torii code will add some boundaries in the Torii code, and then add more degree of freedom. And it's how we can encode logical qubits by having a pair of holes. We can define a new logical Paulis, like for instance this chain of X Paulis and this chain of Z that are characterizing a site pair of holes, and we have the same with placket holes, for instance. And it has been shown by Robert and his collaborators that this scheme is, we can implement Paulis and CNOT gates topologically, and by adding magic state injection, we can achieve universality. But now we are introducing a new twist defect in the lattice so that we can implement the Hadamard gate. So here is a twist defect. So this unit cell, is instead of being close to this one, is a bit slightly shifted so that its corner lands in the center of another unit cell, and the nice bicoloring I showed you earlier is no longer valid. So we need to change that, and here we introduce some arbitrary boundary where the coloring cannot be defined. So this qubit is either black on this side but red on the other side. And we can show that if we have a line of Z measurement here, that here in the input torii code give us a sight hole. On the output torii code on the other side, this will give you a placket hole. But while doing that, here's the X logical that was encoded in the sight hole becomes a placket logical, which is now a Z Pauli operator. So X is mapped to Z, and Z is mapped to X, and that is exactly what a Hadamard gate does. And thanks to having Pauli, CNOT, and Hadamards, we can also have the C gate, and now all tuple and all the whole Clifford group is now accessible topologically. And that has a great advantage is by reducing the operational overhead of all those gates. So the overhead is the operational cost of the gate, and we want to reduce it in quantum computation. So here is a plot of the number of necessary operation per gate given the number of gates in the circuits. And so we see that for the CNOT and the new Hadamard, we have a relatively low overhead. And the same for the S gate, in this new framework, we managed to reduce the overhead quite dramatically compared to the case where we had to use magic state distillation. And here, on top of that, we have this nice smooth increasing because of different round of magic state distillation, we had like this exponential growth than those kinks. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry I can't be there. I'm Jonty. I'm a new lecturer or assistant professor setting up my group at Newcastle University here in the UK. And I'm here to talk about some work I did towards the end of my postdoc with Holger Hoffmann. Basically, again, we've quite provocatively titled this presentation Measurement Back Action Causes the Difference Between Classical and Quantum Counterfactual Effects. I have just put in the chat for those of you who are online the archive. So we only put this up on the archive on Friday under the title Contextuality, Back Action, and Information Gain in Multi-Path Interferometers. It's a very interesting piece of work, and I'm really excited to start sharing it with people. Next slide, please. So basically what we did is looked at one of the most foundational things that you can, the Ehlers-Weibern-Bond tester, or that sort of scenario, where effectively you have an interferometer and you want to sort of compare what the effect is between it as it is and it when one of its paths is blocked with an absorber. So again, as the figure shows, this is our nice generic multipath single particle interferometer. We have an absorber, we have some inputs, we put things into the inputs, single particle, potentially in a superposition across the inputs, and we look at the probability distribution over the outputs or outcomes, depending on whether or not that absorber is in place. Next slide, please. Ooh, there we go. And basically what we wanted to do was look at the information we get or the distinguishability of these two cases, whether or not the absorber is in place. And so we wanted to think about what this would be classically. And so defining this statistical difference distance as a measure of this sort of information that we have based on the output distribution we observe, We see classically this is always PA. Basically, the only way that we know that the absorber is in place is from the photons lost in the distribution across the outcomes. And so we want to think of a counterfactual gain, the gain that you get by having a quantum system in this scenario. Again, we're comparing this to a classical scenario, sort of, for instance, a Galton board or something like that, where you're putting little balls through one at a time and observing their effects, which, of course, we know is not how quantum particles work, but we want to assess what the difference is. And this difference, so this counterfactual gain, you can see here, the statistical distance minus PA, obviously, because it's classically always PA, we are able to get here effectively by looking at cases where, unlike the classical case, where the probability of our particle arriving at the detectors will always go down or stay the same when the absorber's in place, looking at cases where this goes up. And so summing over the probability gain in this case, as you can see here, this Pm given Xa, where Xa is the absorption event, minus Pm, which is the probability when we don't have an absorption, this can be rewritten, as we show in the paper, into two terms. One which we call the Elitzer-Weidman term, because it's the only term that really applies in Elitzer-Weidman style scenarios, and one which is proportional to a Kirkwood-Dirac term. However, this Kirkwood-Dirac term seems to only really have an effect when it's negative. If the Kirkwood-Dirac term is positive, all we get is the same effect we would get in an Elitzer-Weidman style experiment, effectively probability going from an artificially biased towards detector being spread more equitably. But when we have a negative Kirkwood-Dirac term, we start seeing some really cool effects that no one really has explored before. I mean, for instance, if we go to the next slide, we can apply this to a nice simple three-path interferometer, where we start off with what we call the NF state going into the inputs, which effectively is the state that's often used in contextuality paradoxes, where supposedly you get nothing in path F, top path, obviously not the case. But as we can see here, even though in the unblocked case, the top case, the output probability because of the design of the interferometer is the same as the input probability for each of the paths, we get the same superposition coming out as going in. If we put this little blocker into this path F, even though it only absorbs 1/9 of the photon's probability, so 8/9 is left, we see a very strong focusing towards this central path. We see it going from an equal distribution over all the outputs to focusing to over half the probability in one output. Again, as I say, the Elitzer-Weidman and protocol similar to that for a single blocker only ever distribute probability more equally. Whereas it seems like using Kirkwood-Dirac negativity, using quasi-probability negativity, is actually able to give us some sort of additional effect. I mean, the question is whether this could be leveraged for metrology or computation. Again, as I say, this is a very recent result we've got, so we haven't had a chance to really probe into the practical uses of it yet. But I mean, given we know that there are links, obviously, between negativity and contextuality, although they're normally formulated through generalized probabilistic theories or ontological model theories, actually looking in the quantum formalism to see what effects these have on interferometers, to me, seems a really interesting path to explore for finding out new sources of quantum advantage from quantum foundations. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Our next presenter is Sydney, also online.
Okay. Are you hearing me? Everything is okay? Yes? Okay. I was tired. So, thank the organizers by the time to present my work. So, I will present to you the title of my work, Wigner and Friends, a map is not a territory, contextuality in multi-transient paradoxes. That's, I relate in this work multi-transient paradoxes like the Wigner-Friend scenario and contextuality in the sheaf approach. So, and here there's the paper on archive. Next slide, please. Okay, so what I mean by multi-transient scenario is a set of agents, and we can work on it with multimodal logic. In special, we suppose the system S4. Won't enter in details, but especially we have the notion of fundamental truth here in the system S4, and we use to visualize it the topological semantics. And in this work specifically, I did something different from the literature, where I use explicitly the knowledge operators. So I use the knowledge operator, this first one here, from the knowledge of an agent. And we have the common knowledge, also known as mutual knowledge, of a set of agents, E, and the DU, and the distributed knowledge of a set of agents. And they differ because the common knowledge is a knowledge that every agent has in common with the group. And the distributed is a knowledge that we have distributed on this set of agents. And to codify the flow of knowledge between the agents, we use the trust relations. Let's just say that if an agent I trusts an agent J, we have that any knowledge that the agent I knows that agent J knows, then the agent I also knows. So we can codify these, use this formalism to codify the Wigner's friend scenario and Frondinger-Henner scenario that is a special scenario that generalizes to show some contradictions on quantum theory, how to deal with quantum theory. And by the sheaf approach to contextuality, we start with a set of measurements and a cover of contexts to codify the compatible measurements. And we define the sheaf of events to attach the outcomes for each context. And we define the empirical model as the presheaf that gives the probabilistic distribution on these outcomes that we call the events, the local events. Usually suppose the non-disturbance condition that imposes the concordance between intersections of two contexts, and we define non-contextuality in the usual way where we are supposing outcome determinism, that we have the model is non-contextual if you have a global distribution which marginalized to each a probabilistic distribution defined on each context by the presheaf. So, next slide, please. So I will just comment the results. The first one is the notion of fundamental truth from the model logic that is imposed by the system S4, that we can get this fundamental truth without supposing it, just by supposing the trust relation. And to do that, I generalize the notion of trust relations to sets of agents. And for each knowledge operator in here, we use the distributed knowledge to define this trust relation and to get the fundamental truth, explaining why we can, even without supposing the fundamental truth, we still get the paradoxes of multivariate scenarios. And as a second application, I constructed a dictionary that translates each measurement scenario to a multivariate scenario. So it's just that we get that each agent has a measurement, and we define the context by the trust given by the mutual knowledge, and imposing the equivalence condition on it, and we can define the global events by the base topology of the common knowledge and the local events by the base topology of the distributed knowledge in the topological semantics. So with this dictionary, we can play with some scenarios, and especially this one here in the right, the Frondinger-Henner scenario, and we show that the scenario multivariate paradox with this red term here is exactly the term that shows logical contextuality of the scenario. So we can identify it, that the paradox is the contextuality itself, what one can identify with this dictionary here. Next slide, please. So to finish and to explain the title of the paper, one need to think about how we choose deontological assumptions to try to explain our models, physical theories. So the notion of a map is not territory, and choose wisely how we impose these possible worlds of the model logic that we are working with. And with this construction, we can save model logic that turns it adequate to deal with non-classical settings at the cost of lambda dependence that the distributed knowledge imposed. And one can identify that paradoxes and contextuality are the same phenomenon up to some limitations of the sheaf approach, the one given by the equivalence condition of the trust relation. And again here, the paper. Thanks. That's all.
Thank you very much. So next speaker is Shiraman Prakash.
Hello, am I audible?
Yeah, it works.
So it's actually gonna be me, Tanay Saha, that's gonna present. So today I'm gonna talk about the work done by me and Professor Prakash on a new family of putrid triorthogonal codes. So if you could go to the next slide, please. Yeah. So we start by asking a natural question. What is the optimal dimensionality of a qudit for fault tolerance? So although we use bits for classical computation, there's no reason to naturally assume that qubits would have the best overheads or thresholds in terms of fault tolerance for quantum computation. And there are also hints that higher dimensions offer advantages like the classical Reed-Solomon codes scaling with dimensions, and also contextuality being a necessary condition for universality for quantum computation. So magic states are a resource used to obtain universality along with the Clifford group. And magic state distillation is an approach in which we distill a fewer number of magic states with a lower noise rate, given a larger number of noisy magic states. So we have a noise suppression associated with each step of the magic state distillation. And when we concatenate multiple magic state distillations, we get that the overhead scales as given by this expression. And this overhead is essentially the number of input states required for a single output state with a desired target noise rate epsilon. And so naturally a lower target noise rate is desirable, because the lower noise rate that we have in our resource state, better our gate teleportation will be using that state. And a parameter that characterizes this overhead is the exponent of the logarithm gamma. So this gamma parameter, known as the yield parameter, can be unambiguously compared across different dimensions. And it has been shown in literature that we do have better yields, better gamma for larger dimensions, both by Krishna and Tillich and Campbell and his collaborators. However, these constructions require quite a large number of dimensions to show like sizable improvements over qubit protocols. So the construction by Krishna needed a dimension of the order of 17 for improvement over qubits. So while theoretically it's an interesting result, practically it may be difficult to have dimensions of the order of 17. So we asked the natural question, can we obtain better yield parameters using qutrits rather than qubits? And this would be of practical relevance, because there have also been experimental realizations of qutrits, as given in the third point. So we actually answer this question in the affirmative by giving an explicit construction of qutrit triorthogonal codes, which do have a better yield parameter than the currently best known qubit protocols. So if we could go to the next slide. Yeah, so triorthogonal codes are quantum CSS codes constructed in such a way that we have a non-Clifford gate transversal. So in particular, it's the diagonal gate from the third level of the hierarchy that is transversal. So the way we construct them is from something that we call classical triorthogonal spaces. So these are linear subspaces of a vector space such that for any three code words in the space, their triple product and dot product are zero within the field of the code. So our construction is as follows. So we have a family of ternary triorthogonal plus ternary classical triorthogonal codes of length 9m and dimension 3m for m belonging to natural numbers. And this code is spanned by the rows of this matrix. So we have a 0, 1, 2, 0, 1, 2 as the first row. And the rest of the code is blocks of three. We have twos and then ones. And these are just diagonal blocks. So using this classical space, a classical triorthogonal space, we can construct quantum triorthogonal codes of this form, 9m minus k, k, 2. And k has to be less than or equal to 3m minus 2, because this is necessary for the distance to remain 2. And the distance of 2 is necessary for magic state distillation. So could we go to the next slide? Yeah. So using that code, triorthogonal code family, we get a yield parameter given as follows. It's log n by k base d. So this expression for gamma is true for triorthogonal codes. And we see that our code family asymptotically goes to 1. And the analogous construction, qubit construction by Bravi and Ha, goes to log 3 base 2. And here you can see the gamma parameter plotted with the size of the code. And the in blue is our construction. And in orange is the previous construction by Bravi and Ha. So we see that we have a significant reduction of the gamma parameter, which is a good thing. That means we need a lower number of input states to attain a similar purity in the output state of putrid magic state distillation. So we have a significant improvement. And while if we do have code families that asymptotically have gamma less than 1 for qubits, they require an inordinate number of qubits, so of the order of 2 power 58. And this is the construction by Hastings and Ha. So all in all, we present a family of codes that seem to be outperforming any qubit codes for a practical number of qubits versus qutrids. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Amir Sabri.
Thank you. Next slide, please. So my background is kind of in the programming language area, if you wish. And one of the beautiful things about this area is you can think of it as a bridge between like mathematics and hardware. We kind of fill that space. You know, programming languages have some mathematical descriptions and models, and you can reason about them, and they're also implemented on the hardware, and we'd like to bridge. And I found that this approach to try to understand the source, the potential source of quantum advantage, is very fruitful. So we'll start with this, in some sense, well-known theorem, but since I found that it's also not as well known as it should be in some areas. So this notion of computational universality, which basically says that to get anything you want from a quantum computation, it is sufficient to have just a Fourier and Hadamard. No complex numbers, nothing, all of these things can be encoded. Efficient encoding, if you're willing to take a small error and take a small overhead. So, Toffoli is just classical computing, so there's nothing interesting there. So the whole thing is about Hadamard. So how do you think about Hadamard? So this is the crux of the idea. It's like the advantage, if there is one, comes from some use of Adam art in a certain way, in a sort of specific way. Adam art is used to do many things or had different definitions. It's clearly a change of basis from Z to X. It is also the square root of negation up to some kind of small corrections. It's a special case of the Fourier transform. So which one of those perspectives can give us the most insight about what the nature of quantum computing and how it differs from classical computing? Next slide, please. So I will show you two different ideas, both recent papers. So you take a classical language and then you want to somehow get Adam art. So here's one way that is very interesting. Instead of taking one classical language, take two. So you have two classical languages. Each language has its own notion of classical things, false, true, not, tofuri, copy, all of these things are classical things. So each language is a completely classical language, but they are internally representing the classical states differently. And this is kind of a black box. We don't know how, but we impose some equations on how these languages must interact. And the equations on the top are graphical representation. They are very simple. They are kind of obvious. The one on the bottom is critical. This is specifying how the two languages interact. And that equation is enforcing essentially complementarity between the two languages. That knowledge in one language about the values in one language gives you zero knowledge in the other language and vice versa. So that's kind of like one way to think about quantum computing. That's very interesting because each of those languages is completely classical. There's no advantage there. And it's exactly how this complementarity equation is implemented that would be the advantage on how you can kind of go back and forth between the two languages is the secret in that setting. Next slide, please. Another idea by kind of leveraging the idea that Adam art is a square root of negation of the X or square root of the X gate is, well, how do you do square roots in experimental, in a lab? Like if you're an ion trap, you know, experimentalist, you just shine the laser for half the time. So it is all about kind of the steps, elementary steps of your computation. So in a conventional classical execution, there's a clock and all of the steps are of the same size and indivisible. If you allow yourself to take half a step and then interleave those half steps, essentially this is quantum. So quantum is a way, I mean, at least in this characterization of quantum computing, I mean, there's obviously like a huge kind of amount of details and theorems and so on to prove, and the citation is up there. But essentially what this says is the only thing that really is happening from that perspective is you're allowing to take a classical language and allow you to take half steps. And that's all that is needed to get a full quantum universality. And again, it's somehow provide advantage. And it seems, I mean, this approach, I'm very excited about it because the idea that you have multiple things running at different speeds is in classical computer science is also used to kind of speed up. If you're serving a bunch of clients and they come at different speeds, and then having multiple servers, different speeds is definitely a way to speed up. Last slide, please. That was the last slide. I thought I had a thank you slide at the end. Well, thank you.